Hi, welcome to the Sifu Mimi Chan Show. Thanks for joining the conversation. Regina Lopez White Skunk is a board member of the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a former co-chair of the Bears Ayers Intertribal Coalition, and a part of the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe. We discuss the historic and present-day struggles of Native Americans and their displacement from their lands. Regina educates me on petroglyphs, the Bears Ayers National Monument, and the climate crisis. President Biden recently expanded protection for the Bears Ayers National Monument in Utah, which is a reversal of what President Trump did to weaken conservation efforts in the area. On October 28th, President Biden signed a proclamation making November Native American Heritage Month. I appreciate taking this time to learn more about the ancestry, traditions, and contributions their communities have made today and throughout history. I am grateful to Regina for sharing her stories and loved learning from her. If you're enjoying these conversations as much as I am, please rate my podcast on your platform of choice and share it with others. If you would like to support with a donation to help keep this podcast going, you can become a patron of the show by visiting my website or patreon.com/SifuMimiChan. For comments or suggestions, reach out on social media at SifuMimiChan. Now on with the show. Hello, hello, Regina. Thank you so much for joining me on my podcast today.
Absolutely. It's an honor.
Oh, well, I am so grateful to be speaking with you about such important matters that I honestly feel a bit embarrassed and ashamed I'm not more knowledgeable about. So I'm always excited to be able to dive into issues that are happening in regions and areas of the United States, especially that, you know, you're fighting so diligently to protect. So I'd love to know a little bit about you first, though. I know that you grew up in Colorado, and I'd love to hear a little bit about your background.
Sure. So I was born and raised in the southwestern corner of Colorado, basically in the Four Corners region, which encompasses the New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah areas. And part of my tribe actually has trust lands located in southeastern Utah. And currently I have one of my eldest children who is raising six of his children in that area. And I say that only because this is an area that has been a focus point of a lot of discussion in representation of the back and forth between President Obama, President Trump, then now President Biden, who has now reinstated the boundaries of the Bears Ayers National Monument.
And since you brought up the Bears Ayers National Monument, maybe you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. And it's an absolute honor to continue to speak of the Bears Ayers National Monument in respect to the landscape. So it is 1.36 million acres in southeastern Utah, which now is, as President Biden has designated, as the Bears Ayers National Monument. Formerly in 2016, President Obama designated 1.35 million acres as the National Bears Ayers National Monument. And soon after, a year after that, President Trump had redacted 85% of that monument and really opened it up to the possibility of economic development in respect to oil and gas and other other development possibilities out in that landscape. And that's one area that, as a former Bears Ayers Intertribal Coalition chairperson, I heavily advocated for the basic necessities of that area to continue to have traditional access by the the people of the area, which include the Navajo, the Hopi, the Ute, the Paiute, and many others to have access to these areas. Historical ties actually originated with the tribes like the Pueblo of Zuni, the Hopi Nation, who have had historical ties, and many other of the Pueblo tribes that have had ties to the land. So when we speak of this area represents not only those who are currently located in these areas, like the Navajo Nation and the Ute Mountain Ute tribe, but many others that have maybe traditionally and aboriginally have basically traveled through these areas and may have been in contact with others and have had traditional ties to these areas. So it hugely represents a lot of our traditional and historical ties. When we speak to the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition, that's a coalition of sovereign voices, which are made up of the Navajo Nation, the Hopi, the Pueblo of Zuni, the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe, and the Ute Indian Tribe of Utah. And they are the ones who heavily advocated as I have when I did serve on that coalition, for the protection and continued access.
I see. And can you just tell me a little even about the name Bears Ears and kind of the significance of that?
Yes. So there's two buttes kind of located central within this landscape that basically look like the bear's ears. Within the Navajo Nation, they have many stories told of the bear and how the parts of, you know, the different parts have been separated from that and thrown in many different directions. And that's what's become part of the landscape. Likewise, the Hopi and the Zuni, they all speak of this area as being very, very significant to their ceremonial and their religious rights to conducting certain pilgrimages into the area. The Utes, we have continuously moved. We're people of a movement. We're people of the movement. And to what? And this is also in respect to many other tribes. What those resources were available out on the land is how we moved and how we utilize them. But that didn't always mean that we were all utilizing the same resources. For the Utes, it could have been a certain set of resources, water, sage, pine, different things like that. And then in respect to the other tribes, it may have been a different sort of resource that they may have been utilizing, which is one of the things that the tribes have continually tried to communicate, that it was all a respective kind of cohabitation of one another, of knowing who and what was utilizing certain resources out on the land during prospective seasons. So we had a certain understanding. We also had our unwritten land management plans that we kind of respectively used in respect to one another. So we knew that if the Utes were utilizing a certain resource, others may have been moving in at different seasons to utilize other resources that may be available or have had been available at different times of the year and seasons. So we kind of had this reciprocal movement of people sharing and occupying these same spaces. So it was very, very important that we all had clear understandings, and how we established that sort of communication was all the writings on the walls, on the canyon walls, the petroglyphs. And this is how we all continued this active story that shared what movement and what events were being experienced out on the land and in the seasons.
Wow, that is so fascinating. So essentially, I was on the website as well, trying to look into some of these areas. And I did see there were some carving or some petroglyphs, I guess you call them, on the walls and things like that. And so you're saying that across different tribes, they all could communicate via these images and things to have that balance so that resources were always going to be available and not kind of how we are doing today, where resources are unavailable because we basically over harvest or over utilize and we just don't have that balance. I think that's super fascinating. What was it? It always seems like there's some sort of constant struggle because it's unfortunate that politics gets really involved in things like climate and the earth and trying to protect land and trying to do something that's not just good for the earth, but also for humanity. Like there are so many things that are intertwined there. But what was that like, kind of that back and forth when, you know, Obama did a Protection Act and then it got reversed and then now we're back. It feels a little bit like a ping pong game, I'm sure for you all, where it's, you just don't know where it's going to land. And was any progress made? And then when it was taken away, what kind of damage was done? And then now that we're back, what do we kind of foresee? I know that's kind of a loaded question. There's a lot of dynamics there, but.
Well, you know, and when we think about the history of indigenous tribes out on the land, we've had a lot that has impacted us individually. We've had a lot that has impacted us overall, straight across the board. And one of the things is loss of land, loss of connection with land, which also means loss of connection with these places. And for my people in particular, we were kind of displaced from these areas. And so in our culture, when we lose a loved one, we kind of tend to not speak of that individual anymore. And so when we were displaced from these places, we looked at land as a family member. And so we discontinued speaking of these places. And so today, when people ask us about certain peaks and certain valleys and certain river systems, it's really hard for someone like myself to speak in respect to the relationship that we continue to have with these places. Because, you know, as tradition has kind of pushed us and nudged us to follow, we look at that as a loss of family. And so I can't speak to certain peaks because they haven't been in my everyday. What has been in my everyday has been the reservation boundaries that currently exist, which may not include those peaks, those river systems, and even those areas, those valleys. And so it kind of poses a little bit of a challenge because today with some of the work that I do, I'm currently an employee of the Montezuma Land Conservancy. And what we do is we try to help, and what my position is held largely accountable for, is to help reestablish those relationships as well as that trust system within the tribal voices on over into the Montezuma, the Dolores, and the San Miguel counties in the southwest portion of Colorado to help introduce and reconnect our indigenous voices to these and existence to these areas. And that has been a real challenge. That's like trying to introduce someone to an ancestor that they really haven't had that contact or that relationship with. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we have been really working hard to do is really try to get people back to the point of valuing land in relationship to like a family member. And that's one of the things that has been most difficult because in this current time and this current position of how the political system is situated, it's really hard for us to reestablish all of that when colonialism has been in place for so many centuries and it has been instilled in our educational systems and other systems. And so it's really hard to try to come back in and undo, reteach, or even reconnect some of the tribal communities and help those that are outside tribal communities to understand what those ties may have been historically, traditionally, and culturally.
Yeah. And, you know, we hear, of course, a lot about the climate crisis and everybody gets kind of on board with it. And some people get on board with it. And I feel like, especially as Americans, we are a little bit selfish as humans. And unless something impacts our daily life, like really impacts us, we really just don't really pay attention, right? It's not because we're bad people. We're very distracted. There's a lot going on. And I know people do care, right? But even so, don't necessarily engage, right? In the way that you're engaging, of course. And maybe, before I ask about how we can engage, can you maybe talk about that, why this is so important, right? That intersectionality, how it's connected to the benefit for, you know, combating climate change and that extinction loss of biodiversity. Like, can you kind of share how those two things intersect and why they do go hand in hand so that we can better understand what really this does in a grand scale?
Sure. So first and foremost, I really want to touch on the simple fact that within the knowledge that is shared on the canyon walls, a lot of the petroglyphs, that is actually a language that many are left to interpret. So hence, it has told us for a long time that what we're going through right now with climate change and so much that is affecting our ecosystems, that has all been experienced in the past. And how do we deal with that, and how do we move forth from that? Some of that is actually taking the time out from our busy schedules, from our busy tension, information through technology, and really taking a look at some of what's shared on those canyon walls, the knowledge that is shared, how some of the resiliency that was developed then may be the some of the answers that we may need to move forth and past what we're experiencing today. Knowledge of yesterday and everything that was experienced is definitely one of the things that we should stop to take a moment to really digest and really attempt to interpret what was experienced in those times, because it's obvious that what they went through then, if they did not come through that, then we wouldn't be here as people, as humanity. There has been a certain amount of resilience that has been developed and experienced that I would say that they were able to come through that. And for us as humanity in this current time, space, with knowledge of both traditional and science, we should be able to braid all of this information together and be able to work through it. The only thing that I always see as a challenge and a test is how government is organized and how we look at things and how we interpret things. And sometimes, unfortunately, a lot of that trust is put into that. And sometimes it leaves us almost with a sense of a lack of hope.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It does feel that way, because especially when things are given and then taken away and then given, and then you feel like it could be taken away at any moment again. So like, how do you, I guess the question is, because I consider myself to be an activist. I'm working currently on a bill here in Florida to help include AAPI history into our education here, because growing up here, there's something that I lacked. And of course, the Native American heritage as well is missing from that. But like, every time you take a step forward, then it feels like you're getting pushed like three steps back. And it's really disheartening. And for Native Americans in particular, I can't even imagine what that struggle is constantly like, and that feeling of invisibility. And then how do you stay in the fight? Like, how do you keep going? And I'm basically just trying to steal some techniques from you to keep on my journey. But how do you kind of take those setbacks?
Well, you know, a lot of it is for me individually is I have learned to really encompass and become the wisdom of my grandparents. And largely, I always say, you know, I am the woman that I am because of my mother, my grandmother, and my great-grandmother, and many that have become and that have come through this before her. You know, without their experience and their handing down stories and knowledge and experience, I wouldn't be able to be the person I am today. My mother has taught me so much in terms of how to overcome and confront difficult moments, like when it feels like, you know, just blatant racism confronts me, or even when somebody is very just downright disrespectful to me as a female. That is one of the hardest things that I have had to deal with, especially with the capacity that I have journeyed through as a former elected official for my tribe, and even more so as being the only female who has sat and come through many of the experiences on the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. To this day, I have been the only female who sat that position. And when you think about dealing with other tribes, their tradition and cultures, and how they view females as leaders or not, that is a huge, huge step. And it's very intimidating. It's also a very, very scary position and journey to walk. And, you know, without the guidance of my grandmothers and my mother and my father, in just confronting some of those, you know, I wouldn't be, and I wouldn't have been able to speak in the passionate form that I have without their guidance, without their teachings. So, you know, the many generations of teachings as a female and the many guidance of grandmothers within the community, I wouldn't have been able to even maintain the position and the voice and the capacity to speak to people without that. So there's a lot of tradition, culture, customs, and heritage that has come through my voice and through my messaging. I don't discount or disrespect others and science. What I have learned is to be able to braid them, braid those grateful things that help to culture and custom has long stood for. And when science speaks, science definitely helps present the capacity of what evidence also can prove that culture of my people has been valid. And that's important for me, because in Western society, without that science validity, what I say wouldn't mean nothing. And it's important to mean something.
Yeah, well said. And, you know, speaking on the customs and traditions path, I am a traditional Kung Fu teacher. And so it is something that I've kind of dedicated my life to. So I connect with you a lot on kind of being a female in a very traditional male role and understanding what that dynamic is like. And just kind of, again, like what you said, learning from your teachers and those in the past and those other matriarchs and things. So I find that all kind of incredible. But as we engage with new generations, are you finding it difficult as tribes and land becomes obsolete and those heritage, that heritage and that lineage just kind of gets further and further away. Do you find it hard to preserve those cultural aspects? And in what ways are you working to do that? Do you find the younger generation to be engaged?
Well, it's interesting because there was a point in my life when I was very heartbroken and it didn't seem like I was finding young people to pick up the capacity of engaging between our worlds, between tradition and culture and custom, and being who we are in this modern sense and Western society of teachings and education and how society is driving a lot of these issues. It was really hard and really scary to think, I can't find any of my young people who could be engaged at the point that I am and have the same passion that I do. And a lot of that came from experiencing things from my grandparents and my upbringing to who I am today as a mother and a grandmother. It really was frightening to see that I could actually even begin to think, oh my God, where are my young people? Because when I start to reach the point of thinking that I'm an elder and retiring and moving on from this type of work, who's going to pick that up? That was really scary for me.
Yeah.
And I cried. I went into, you know, the sweat ceremony. I went into many other ceremonies carrying this question and asking, you know, where is this going to lead my people? Where is this going to lead the world? And, you know, lo and behold, whenever you put a question out to the universe, out in prayer, out in ceremony, you should have enough confidence that you're going to receive an answer. And I have. And I think that it just takes a matter of patience and continued passion for sharing it and never giving up on that. And I did eventually receive an answer. Many young people approached what I thought was a very noble answer to my question, which was, they said, our people have been people of running endurance. Our people have always been of that form of continuing to help us either survive and continue resilience development. And they said, we want to do a run. So a group of young people approached a group of other people and said, we want to do a prayer run in response to the redaction of the boundaries by President Trump. And so we ran, many of us ran, many of the communities from their Pueblo villages and communities ran to the central location at Bears Ears in southeastern Utah. And we collectively, in a relay form, covered over 800 miles. And the furthest stretch started at Santa Ana in New Mexico, just outside of Bernalillo, New Mexico. We put our bodies to the test to show how committed we are to this. And I say this in the form of we, because on the Ute leg, I started my people. I ran the first 3 miles to start my young people in this running effort. And that, for me, was like a demonstration of handing off the baton to the young people. For me, that was important. It was also very an emotional time for me, because this was like seeing a prayer answered. And these young people were rising to the occasion. 2 weeks later, I accompanied a young lady to the UN to deliver a statement in behalf of Bears Ears. These young people were driving this. These young people were answering what I had put out to the universe and out to our creator, saying, where are my young people? And here they were. They're also very, very vocal about how they feel connected to the land. And that restored my faith in young people. That restored my faith in being able to have the ability to hand over the leadership, the voice, and the passion onto another generation. And for me, that was very, very touching, but it also helped me to believe in one of the requests of my elders. My grandmother, who was born in the Bears Ears area, one of the things that she was very gracious about was continuing to be a supporter of the work. But even more, she was well over 90 something years old, born in that area, not born in a hospital. But one of her requests was to be laid to rest in this area. 1 week to the day after President Trump redacted the boundaries of Bears Ears, she passed away. I always believed that she not only passed away from maybe years of seeing change and whatnot in her experience, but I believe that she had a sense of a heartbreak. I believe that some of that she passed from was seeing the protection of land that she loved being protected and watching it not being protected. And fortunately enough, we were able to lay her to rest in the location that she requested. But it's a reality. This is how tied we are to these places. The young people tell us how important it is. Our elders tell us of the life they lived out in these places. These stories are real. These stories are important. These stories need to continue to be told.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing all of that. And so inspired. The 800 plus mile run, all of that was just so inspiring and heartbreaking at the same time. But I tend to just see that, you know, through that adversity is when those triumphs come, right? And so you were looking for the youth to come out. And I think because that former president, you know, redacted the protection and they saw what was happening, like that's what was needed to kind of rise up and to gain that momentum. And I would love to touch on, if you're open to sharing, a little bit about your adversity, because you clearly are coming from a place of having challenges. And you said you had, you know, encountered racism and discrimination, not just as a female, but also because of your heritage and culture. And if you're open to it, no pressure, if you're open to it, I just feel like these are the type of stories that people learn from, because these firsthand experiences are what are the most impacting. And if you're open, I would love for you to share some of that adversity and why you're so driven, because you're clearly so passionate about what you do and have done so much.
Sure. And I'm open to it. I'm open to sharing my story. So originally, when I first got married, I lived in southeastern Montana and had spent pretty close to 15 years out there near the Hardin and Billings area. I was living on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation and decided to go to school. And I returned back to college at a tribal college at Chief Dull Knife College in Lame Deer, Montana. And I started my educational journey there. I received my Associate's of Science in Business Management, and then later continued on to my Bachelor's in Information Technology. And that's where I really started to see the position of females. I remember going into a class and my instructor, one of the first things he said before he read the syllabus, mind you, and he said, take a look at your fellow class members. You see three females in the class. I guarantee you only one will finish because of the difficulty of this field and this course. Unfortunately, he was absolutely right. There was one that would finish. and the other two had dropped. I happened to be that one who finished, but I will never forget that because I think that that actually initiated some doubt within the other two.
Yeah.
I know that information technology is a field largely male dominant. And I fought my way through that. But I also fought my way through that to find my tribal experience, my indigenous me at the other side of that. When I came home after spending 12 years in the field of information technology, I was then approached by elders who had been asking, and one in particular who came to me every day and said, Regina, we want you to run for tribal leadership. We want you to run for tribal council position. And it was really funny because I used to say, you know, the only thing I'm going to do is run away from you. And we used to laugh about that. And we all know that in our culture, is very healing, and it's a good thing to embark upon many different difficult decisions. But by the end of the day, and I remember this in the 11th hour, I finally decided that, okay, well, I will run. So I completed all my filings within the last hour, might you, collected names on a petition that stating that I would be a good person that would fill a candidacy position. And I did. And I entered the election for my tribal council. And mind you, I got in by 3 votes. I'm a big person who believes in every vote counts, because I got into tribal leadership because of 3 votes. Mm-hmm. But that also told me that 3 people above the others believed in me, believed that I could hold a position, and that me, Regina Lopez Whiteskunk, could be a female who could make a difference. And I took that very seriously. And when those opportunities arose, I took them. I took them courageously, whether I had experience or knowledge. I knew that I had to have great commitment in myself to approach the challenges of having to be a leader for my tribe, for my community, for my people. I served the first year as a treasurer, and boy, did I get a huge amount of experience, which was very scary. I mean, try holding, like a corporation in your hands. Try holding, your tribe in your hands. That's a very scary position to be in. The second year, I chose not to continue down that path. But that was the point that I became involved with the Bears Ears protection and initiative. And boy, did I get the biggest experience of a lifetime. I got to work with the president's administration. I got to work with Department of Interior and a lot of high-leveled agency people. I got to learn process. And I also got to learn how important it is to have public process protected, because that is the only thing that helped to maintain, aside from a few large, important conservation groups that would help to support our position on Bears Ears. But it was really the people. When you look at public lands belongs to every one of us, every United States citizen. This is lands that we should protect because they have stories to tell. They have knowledge to share with us. And we need to protect these open spaces, these wild places, because that is where we will learn about our ecosystems. This is where we will learn about relationships between land and people, relationships between the ecosystem elements and people. Mm-hmm. And these sometimes are not things that you learn in textbooks or that you find in libraries, but they are learned through personal experience of walking on the land and listening to the leaves tell a story, hearing the water sing his story, sing a song, the birds, the animals. And if you're lucky, you may even run into wild animals in their elements. These are things that you can only learn in these wide open wild spaces. And this is why they need to be protected.
Yeah, 100%. And if it's appropriate to ask, and I want to learn more, can you tell me, I'm always fascinated about genealogy and names, and I would love to know a little bit more about the white skunk name and how all of those things kind of come about and more about some of the ceremonies as well.
Sure. I can share with you a little bit about the names. Ceremonies are a little bit more touchy.
Sure. Of course.
But so my name is, my maiden name is Lopez. My married name is White Skunk, which actually comes from my late husband, who was of the Southern Cheyenne descent. And has a lot of ties to people in Oklahoma, but also even more importantly to the Sand Creek Massacre. So there's that part of the story. And then Lopez, my maiden name, actually comes from when the Spanish had occupied this part of the country prior to the United States government being organized and pushing westward. Lopez, basically, when we had agency with the Mexican and the Spanish government, when it came time to documenting individuals, when they couldn't spell or pronounce traditional names, a lot of them just began to say, okay, it's easy just to label and identify these people as something we know. And so some of us came into those names of Lopez, and it was very, very common in the Southwest. If you travel through many of the tribes that are located in the Southwest, you'll hear people Gomez, Lopez, and other Hispanic names. And people will ask you, well, you came into these names one of two ways. Either someone married in to those areas, or someone just was pure lazy and didn't want to try to spell out the traditional names. So they just gave you a name, and that's the rolls. That's the name that you went down documented on the rolls with. And that's kind of the story that my family has shared, is that they did not want to document our family by our traditional names or native names. And then we just kind of said, well, Lopez is easy and Lopez is Spanish. And so that's kind of just a reflection of the occupancy of the Spaniards out in our lands. Mm-hmm.
And on October 28th, President Biden signed a proclamation that November would be Native American Heritage Month. What is the significance of that in your eyes?
Yay. It's about time. And, you know, as I have always lived my life, you know, with a lot of the traditional cultural customs and values of my family, every day is Native American Heritage Day. Every day that I wake up, every day that I say my prayers and I see the sunrise on the horizon, it's our day, and that's who we are. I don't need anything to acknowledge that. I don't need anybody to recognize that. And I don't need anybody to tell me that this is a special time, because every day is that day for many of us. And it's not that it's a religion. It's a way of life. This is something that we are raised with. This is who we are. And this clearly demonstrates our strong ties to the land, our strong ties to our culture and customs, but even more, our strong ties to the teachings of our elders and our ancestors. Many of us practice it, and many of us might speak, write, and understand English, but that doesn't mean that we're English or we're of that any other descent. We know who we are. And you know, it's unfortunate that it took this long for that to happen. It seemed like that would have been something that would have happened a long time ago. Many of us have always had these little side discussions. It's odd we see, you know, National Hispanic Month, National Black Heritage Month. Well, it's odd that the first Americans had to wait this long for something like this to finally come. But it's not that it's going to stop us from being who we are. We are here even through the many atrocities, through the many policies that try to extinguish our culture, our ties to the land, and our identities. We're still here. We are still who we are, and we will continue to practice as we've been taught by our ancestors.
Yeah. I'm always curious of how every culture sees themselves portrayed in television and film, and especially, if, of course, in the, you know, we have a long history of television and film that I think has been slowly evolving. And I was curious, one, have you seen Reservation Dogs? And I wanted to know if you've seen it and what you think, but also if there's, you know, some stereotypes that you can kind of dispel, or things that have been really just absolutely incorrect that we often have to see in the media all the time, that's always portrayed.
Well, no, I haven't seen Reservation Dogs.
Okay.
But, you know, I have seen other films, videos, and documentaries that, you know, really put out a long and a strong representation that Native Americans are alcoholics. You know, we have drug addictions, domestic violence is strongly present. And these all put out a message to the world that every one of us is of this, and it isn't true. I even recall during a time when we were seeking the designation of Bears Ears, when Congressman Bishop had published an op-ed in the New York Times, and it basically told that whole story of every negative element that could ever be recorded on many reservations, but it did not ever come through that messaging that any of us could be educated, could be well held, could be advocates, or that we could be anything other than all of those negative things. And really, many of us will represent the best. We'll continue to try to communicate messaging of who we are and our beauty of culture, our beauty of language, connection to land, and who we are today, which is completely opposite of all the negativity that always gets put out into mass media. And, you know, I would love for somebody to come along and tell the story of every aspect of how we learn from the plants, the many things that we take into ourselves when we conduct ceremony, and how we come out stronger people, more resilient, because it's more than obvious we have come through and triumphed through those negativities, because we're still here. We're still trying to live our lives and teach our children.
Yeah. And actually been to Red Rock, and I saw that there is a, you know, Red Rock Wilderness Act, which I want you to talk about. But it's so fascinating because I've heard you, you know, speaking for this last hour about this connectivity with the land. And I am actually like allergic to practically everything. And so like every time I get out in nature, it's like a whole thing. But like being out there, you really do feel like you're just transported to another world. And there's this like stillness, and I'm not even a big hiker or anything, but I really enjoyed my time there, like the beauty of the what of the land, like you're saying, like it's so prevalent and it's so overwhelming. And just I think all of us being able to kind of transport ourselves and take ourselves and take moments to go and enjoy those pieces, whether it is just a plant or it is something as incredible as the Grand Canyon or Red Rock or all these wonderful places that, you know, Bears Airs and all these places that are there for us that we just kind of overlook. But could you talk a little bit about the Red Rock Wilderness Act and what that significance would be and how important that is?
Absolutely. So the American Red Rock Wilderness Act actually has been introduced into Congress. And one of the things that I would really truly love people to understand is, although the Bears Ears National Monument is a proclamation used, but the president has utilized the Antiquities Act of 1906 to proclamate and have protection cast over 1.36 million acres. What the Red Rock Wilderness, American Red Rock Wilderness Act will do is provide a certain amount of other protection over the same landscape, which cannot be undone by another president. So it would help to solidify certain protections in a manner that would no longer be volatile to change. But the Wilderness Act also provides opportunity for groups that may, or other groups outside of higher educational institutions, conservation groups, but to be able to come out and study these areas, document some of what is out there, to allow for others to understand what the value of land, what the relationship between people and the elements and all that's around, and how that all can be encompassed in the greater thought of protection, protection beyond just the stroke of a pen by a president and his administration, but something that would be long lasting. And I believe that this area, through this Wilderness Act, does also allow for these groups to be able to bring in funding to conduct these types of activities, learning opportunities, and documenting these areas to better help solidify why this is warranted for protection, but for a better understanding of why this needs and is warranted by and for protection. Ancestral Puebloan sites, the final resting place of my ancestors and many other Indigenous people. The ties to these areas is so significant, but also allows for recreation to occur out on these lands. How we use these lands is something we want to protect. Largely in part, one of the greatest things that I would love to see continue protected is public process. How we can, as a public, as individuals, can share what these lands mean to us. And how do we share that? Who do we share that to? We share that to our elected leaders in Washington. The American Red Rock Wilderness Act has been shared both in the House and in the Senate. It will not be heard through hearing this Congress, but will be up for possibly the next Congress. So ways that we can help continue to share how important this landscape is to better research this area, come to a clear understanding of what these areas might mean to people, and even if and inspire people to come out and visit to understand why it is important for these areas to be continued to be protected, and the opportunities for documenting the importance of this area, as well as also protecting it from oil and gas development and other minerals that should be possibly left in the earth rather than having to seek out what those importances are through the loss of land and possible threats and contamination to these areas.
Yeah. And I, from what I read, it's also just stopping that loss of nature also addresses part of the climate crisis, which of course scientists are saying, hey, you know, there's a certain percentage that we can do to protect the earth. And, you know, here there is land and it's just not protected. And so that would also be an added benefit and something that's widely important, obviously. And, you know, that I think would be something that should be prioritized. So what can we as citizens do? So you're doing all the heavy lifting, you're doing all of the real work, but you know, what would you recommend for listeners, for somebody who heard your story and cried a little bit with you today on some of those moving things that you shared? What is one action that someone can do that's really bite-sized and that will take us that step in that direction? What would you recommend?
I strongly recommend that you do a little research, learn about this area. And one of the places that you can go to is a website for Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. You can also learn about the historical campaign to seek designation for Bears Ears by visiting the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition website. And I would strongly encourage, once you read and do your research, to reach out to your elected officials and express how important these areas are, and that this America's Red Rock Wilderness Act, how this is important and how this will play a big part in the 30 by 30 initiative in trying to help preserve and ensure that other generations beyond our grandchildren will have the same opportunities to experience that we have. I would just really, really tell your story to your elected officials how important it is to have wild open spaces and the ability and opportunities to have these spaces studied, documented for the better understanding for our world.
Yeah. Well, that is the perfect end, I think, to this podcast. You've summed it up so nicely. So everybody, I will link all of those things for you here so you can very easily access those websites and also donate to this amazing organization and to the work that they're doing. So there's several ways that we can all make a difference, and maybe not as impactful as Regina, but we will all be there to help try to lift you up. So Regina, thank you so much for sharing with me today. I learned so much from this conversation, and I hope our paths will meet again.
Thank you. I hope so too. Please feel free to reach out to me anytime. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. That's all for today's episode. Thanks for listening to the Sifu Mimi Chan Show. Please subscribe and rate my podcast on your platform of choice and leave a review. You can become a patron of the show at patreon.com/SifuMimiChan to help keep this podcast going. Follow me and interact on social media at SifuMimiChan on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook.